It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back next week. Coming up yesterday, 100 activists headed to the Capitol building to ask for parole reform in the state's prisons. We'll speak with a minister and former deputy district attorney about that. First, we're getting an updated set of manners for the 21st century. The days of Emily Post and stuffy etiquette might be over, but that doesn't give us a free pass to be rude to everybody either. These days, there are people constantly yelling into cell phones when maybe they should be paying attention to their coffee order, leaving their dog's calling card in your yard and looking at their phones instead of at you over the dinner table. Why does it seem like our world is suddenly full of so many rude people? And what can we do to stop these people from being jerks when we see it? Amy Elkin is here to help us. She's the writer of The Advice Goddess, a science-based syndicated column that runs in about 100 newspapers across North America. She's also the author of Good Manners for Nice People. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, you say we are more rude now than ever before.
Well, I say we're experiencing more rudeness because the truth is rudeness is the human condition. But the problem is we now live in societies too big for our brains.
And what does that mean?
Well, a British anthropologist named Robin Dunbar measured the human brain size, and he figured out that we have a capacity for about 150 relationships. And this made sense because we evolved in these very small bands where we knew everyone. And when you know everyone, they have to behave differently than if they're strangers. And now we live in these vast strangerhoods where we are around people much of the day, many of us, that we have never seen before and will never see again. And if they are jerks, they can do anything to you, and many of them do.
So they can just toss their garbage on your yard, or in your case, you thought you saw a guy peeing near your fence, and they'll never see you again, so maybe it's okay to be rude, is what our brains are thinking.
Well, you're basically no one and nothing to them, and that's how they treat you. And yes, so they feel that they can do this with impunity, whatever they want, basically. Be as rude as they want, act as entitled as they want, and nothing will happen to them. And I would like to change that, to bring back shame, basically.
What does shame do for us?
Well, we evolved to have a great concern for our reputation. And so even when we don't know people, if we make them feel as if everyone's looking at them, this enacts our evolved psychology where this would have been a problem. So I like to do something called web slapping with the egregiously rude. The people who aren't just, oh, I wasn't mindful, but the people who are tell you to, you know what, off, and they're going to keep their loud cell phone call going. So I like to videotape them and post it to the web. And even if they don't see it, other people who are terribly rude will see that and think, uh-oh, not I should be a better person, but I might get caught.
So you have to be pretty quick on the draw with your cell phone, but are you ever worried that someone's going to come after you when they see you filming them?
Well, I do it clandestinely when I do it, and I encourage that in other people. And also, I mean, you have to be a little bit prudent. If someone looks like they're a gang member and they're armed, maybe just let it go.
So what are some instances where you've done that? Can you give us an example of web slapping from your own life?
Sure. On my cute little street here in Venice, California, I'm a Midwesterner, but I moved here because there are palm trees and it's warm all the time. I'm from Michigan. But someone dumped all this trash, bags and boxes of trash, on my cute street. And they actually made the mistake of leaving their name on and in the trash. I went through it Nancy Drew style with rubber gloves, figured out who they were, demanded on Facebook that they remove their trash. And when they didn't, posted about it on my website, naming names. And then they still didn't come pick it up. And so they were actually, it was a famous foreign surgeon and his wife. And they had sent these curtains to somebody in a very ritzy neighborhood here. So I mailed a sampling of their trash to their friend in the $2.5 million house saying, could you please tell these people to come pick up their garbage?
Wow. And did it work?
Well, it worked in the sense that it showed other people that there are people who are watching, that you can't get away with it. So I don't know. These people, obviously, I messaged them and everything, and their friend knows and told them. But are they new people? Are they better people? Do they care about strangers? Or do they just think they're going to get away with it? I think the latter is probably true. But they might think twice just because somebody is there to catch them. And that's been an example for them.
Well, you're using technology to shame some people. Technology also, you say, is at the problem, at the root of some of our rudeness. Now, it doesn't necessarily cause the rudeness, but we're not always using our technology well. What are we up against when it comes to technology and rudeness?
Well, we got all this technology with no rule books. When the phone first came out, they actually published a book about how to use it. And we're in the Wild West here. And so what happens, one thing is that research shows that a one-sided conversation, so a cell phone conversation, commandeers the brain in a way a two-sided conversation, like two people talking in a coffee shop, does not. Because your brain tries to fill in the side of the conversation you can't hear. Now, people don't know that, but what it means effectively is that even having a conversation in a low tone on a cell phone in public, it basically gives all these people, other people around you, what I call neural itching. It's really annoying to people.
Right. And there's some comedy based on that I've heard of, where people will stand and answer the cell phone questions, the other side of the conversation of people that are talking on their phones, just to illustrate a point.
Well, yes, I've done that. But the problem is that you can really annoy all the people who are already annoyed even more. You don't want to become part of the problem. And that's part of the problem with people in traffic. People want to videotape them. Well, you don't get to crash your car because some guy's a jerk, some other guy in another car. You have to behave as if basically the root of manners is empathy, which it is, that we have to think about, gee, how will that affect other people? How might it affect other people?
I want to talk about, when we're on the subject of the phone, want to talk about one of the things that is sort of the classic dilemma of our age right now. It's that you're out to dinner, you're engaging with another person face to face, but that person is on their phone a lot. They're checking their texts. Maybe something comes up in conversation and they want to back check it on their phone and make sure it's right. And before you know it, you know, it's them having an intimate night out with their phone and you're witnessing it. What do you do about that?
It's just terribly rude. Now, I understand if there's a conversation and someone says, well, why don't you look that up? That's different than what people do. And what people do, whether on their phones the whole time, this is effectively like bringing a legal pad and doing your office work while somebody else is sitting there waiting for you. It's really, really hurtful. The other person is just left to sort of look into their napkin as if they're searching for secret messages. They feel as if everyone's watching them. And again, it brings up the empathy thing. I mean, that's a really awful thing to do to another person. And I'm big on people not allowing themselves to be victimized. Now, if you give that person sort of an angry lecture or hurt lecture, then you're still acting victim-y. And so what I like to do in a situation like that, my friends don't do that to me, I think they know better, but even if they're that rude, but is to say, well, you know, I'll be outside. When you finish your call, you come get me. Because that makes the point without being all hurt and woundy about it. And that person, I think, will be more likely to see that they're being a jerk.
Now, you're a big advocate of speaking out when you experience rudeness. You think this is, it's part of your shaming thing that you think will bring us all to heal a little better. But sometimes it backfires. Can you tell us a story about the time you saw a guy, you thought he was doing something unsavory on your fence, and it turns out, I don't know, maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. But what happened?
Oh, I think you're talking about, well, there was a guy who was, and people treat the great outdoors like it's a great big bathroom where I live, and that's really not right. It makes it smell like a men's bathroom when it rains. But actually, maybe you're talking about the girl in the Volkswagen. There was a girl, we're real close to the street right here. She had opened her car window and was having a loud argument on her cell phone, on her speakerphone in her car. And this is like being in an auditorium and broadcasting to the entire block. And I normally know better. I try not to behave in a counterproductive, hot-headed way, but I was already annoyed about something. And I just came out on my porch and I said, "We can hear you indoors," or something like that. And this girl, instead of doing what she does when I do the right thing, which is matter-of-factly letting someone know, excuse me, hey, you know, you probably didn't know, but we're real close to the property line here. That tends to make people want to be polite. But my sort of angry reaction to her made her come up to my gate, yell for about 5 minutes straight, and then vandalize my mailbox.
So that didn't go down the way you wanted.
No. But I use this. I say in the book, I do not have perfect manners. In fact, I have substandard manners like everybody. That's being human. But what I try to do is look at things like that and use it as a learning experience for how I'm not going to behave again. And I have done that pretty much. Not done that where you just launch off at somebody and where you instead use that matter of fact, basically acting like you believe somebody has good manners and maybe they just didn't remember or didn't notice. And then you let them decide to behave well.
We're talking right now to columnist Amy Alkin about her new book. It's called Good Manners for Nice People. And we're taking your calls next. Have you ever dealt with rude people in your life? I'm sure you have. How do you deal with them when you come across them? Do you believe in confronting them and saying something? And what is your technique for doing so? How does it pan out for you? And what kind of manners do you think should be universal? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation now with columnist Amy Alkin about her new book, Good Manners for Nice People. We're taking your calls now. How do you deal with rude people in your life? Do you think people are ruder now than ever? Or maybe it's just a matter of degree. What is your code of manners? Do you confront people when you come across it, or do you just walk away and feel bitter? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. And we'll go to our phone lines now. We have Paula with us from Oshkosh. Hi, Paula.
Oh, hi. How exciting. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two comments, actually, and I'll try to be brief. The one, I was out to lunch with a couple of very dear friends, one of whom we share the same birthday. It was a birthday luncheon, and both of them had their phones out, and they were texting and texting and texting. And I was frustrated. We don't live in the same city, and we don't get together very often. And finally I said, put your expletive phones away. I mean, it wasn't a terrible expletive, but I know that wasn't the right thing to say, but I was absolutely appalled. We're all really good friends, and like I said, we don't get together very often. And I thought your columnist comment was so funny about, oh, look at this interesting napkin, because I was kind of doing that. I was fidgeting. And my other comment is, whenever I visit any place, a retail store, a clothing store, a fast food store, and I'm giving them my hard-earned money, they don't say thank you. I don't know how we've lost that. I end up saying thank you 2, 3, 4 times, and I never get a thank you. It's no problem or have a good day. And I'm just curious what your columnist thinks about that.
Great, Paula. Thank you. A couple of good stories there from Paula. What do you think about those two incidences?
Oh, boy, do I sympathize with her. And this is our impulse. Our impulse is to lecture people in the moment. And believe me, it is my impulse too. But what's really important is to not act in counterproductive ways. And scolding people in the moment tends not to work, first of all, because you're shaming them. And secondly, because there are two of them doing this. This is a sort of form of reverse peer pressure. It allows people more leeway when they see that they aren't the only one. A more effective thing to do is to wait until afterward, or to take one person aside, and to email someone and say, you know, just in a not a very accusatory way, criticizing people does not make them change. It makes them want to clobber you. To let them know that you felt badly, because sympathy really works as a motivator. It's very effective.
But then you have to sit through the whole lunch while they're on their phones.
Well, it's a problem when there's a group. If you're in a group, I would talk to the other person there, you know, or either that. It really is just this thing of yelling at people. She didn't say what happened, but it tends to make for bad feelings in the moment. And so it tends to be ineffective. The people, they aren't going to become better people because you do this. And they probably actually will want to fight back and say, oh, but it's not a big deal. That's the problem. You make them defensive instead of making them change.
And what about the thank you at stores?
Oh, this is a generational thing with a no problem. People who are basically, I think, over 55 or 50, 55, 60, it makes them almost homicidal when someone says thank you and they say, when they say thank you and the person says no problem. But I think they're a little picky about that because the person isn't indicating that it would be a problem. This is just a way of speaking. And so that's something that where people, I think people are too picky. But really, the thing where people aren't saying thank you, that's pretty awful. It's a convention, a nice convention. We look for that. It's sort of a dignity violation when you say thank you and the person says nothing.
Right. It's a bit of closure.
Yeah. And you can repeat the thank you, but in a nice way. See, once you get sort of nasty about it, then the person, again, it makes them want to fight back. And you can, the thing that may work, I haven't tried this, but is to say thank you like they just forgot to say you're welcome in a cheerful tone.
All right. Well, Paula, thank you. And I hope we gave you some advice there for the thank yous. And we're going to go next to Rose in Bayside. Hi, Rose.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a son who has autism, and over the years, we've suffered comments and stares and advice. And one of the things that has worked for me is to just say, you know, we're trying our best. Thank you so much for your input. And I think that serves to both shame and educate people. So that's just something that's worked for me.
Okay, well, that's a great approach. What do you think, Amy?
Oh, I think that's great. It's really great because she's not scolding people. And her approach is tends to bring up sympathy in people. I have a little friend who has autism, and his mother will, if she takes him, for example, to a school event, and she's very careful to not take him places where he is going to bother people terribly. They eat out at loud restaurants, for example. But she'll say to people, my son has autism, to people around her, and, you know, I hope that there won't be any outbursts. We're working very hard on this. And if there is, you know, please bear with us, and we're going to go outside. And so this lets people know ahead of time that you aren't just a parent with entitled children, but that you're working on this, and it's something that's real challenging for both parent and child.
So that sounds like something that acknowledges something. You treat someone else as a person worthy of your time and respect by acknowledging you might be inconveniencing them and then asking them to be patient with you.
Right, because people like that. If we all have moments when we're sort of loud or we bother people, and if you seem like you care about that, that you don't just think, oh, deal with it, this really makes people much more likely to go along with you rather than think you're just a jerk.
All right, well, thank you so much for sharing your story, Rose. And we go next to Andrea in Kaukauna. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. I'm calling to discuss a rude episode I had last night as a soccer coach. The opposing team, I had no subs on our team, so all my kids were on the field. And the three players that were subs for the opposing team were near me, close enough that I could hear them start to yell at my players. We were winning at this point. Treat them like dirt. Kick them. They're terrible. I'm just yelling mean things to my players. My kids are looking, the refs were looking out, you know, looking at these kids. Their coach never did anything. So after a couple minutes, I finally had it. And I tried to politely say, girls, I've heard enough, you need to knock it off. And that's as mean as I said it. And the coach turns to me, and he clearly could hear me say that, which I didn't even yell at. What did you just say to my players? And I said, I told them to knock it off. They are yelling horrible, mean things out at the field. And the ref immediately heard the discussion. And I'm a small female, and he's this big guy. And I thought, you've got to be kidding me. And long story short, the ref came over. He's like, I've been listening to your players. It's completely all uncalled for. In our league, if you show anything unsportsmanlike, you're supposed to get a red card. By the way, these are U-12 girls soccer players. This is not it's a rec league. It's not competitive. I mean, technically it's competitive, but it's not it's a recreational league.
Okay, so ultimately the ref sided with you on that.
Oh, completely. And then the coach acted like he never heard what they said. I don't know if then he feared that he would get in trouble. So later he did, while game was still playing, you know, came up to me. He did apologize then. And said, I'm sorry, I guess I didn't really hear what they were saying. But it was very insincere. And then those three girls, every time they subbed back out, then I could hear them, and they were very loud and were saying, well, what can we do? And then they insisted on coming as close to me as possible and in a very mean voice yelling, go yellow team. And I was polite. I did nothing.
So you were getting some back talk there on that. What about that situation? Sports can be tough. There's a tradition of talking smack, but it sounds like, you know, it's crossing the line. This is supposed to be a game of sportsmanship at this age.
Yeah, it sure is. And Andrea behaves so well because it is so easy to go off on people in this situation. And for as dismaying as it is, the behavior of the coach and these three girls, you should really feel good about staying classy and that these people are not accountable. This is not surprising. There's something that we, a human bias called confirmation bias. You know, we like to look at things only that confirm that we're right and not look at things that disconfirm that. And this coach didn't want to believe that he or his team had done anything wrong, but they absolutely were wrong. And he knew that despite his insincere apology. And I love that he was forced into that and that the ref, through your sort of classy and firm persistence, came over and finally did something.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Andrea. And Amy, thanks to you for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking to Amy Elkin, writer of The Advice Goddess, a science-based syndicated column that runs in about 100 newspapers across North America. She's also the author of the new book called Good Manners for Nice People. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back on Monday. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk with a Great Lakes explorer who says he's found the remains of a 335-year-old ship in Lake Michigan. That's ahead in today's Curious Wisconsin. Yesterday, 100 activists from around the state headed to the Capitol building to ask for parole reform in the state's prisons. They attended a public meeting with Wisconsin's Corrections Secretary Edward Wall and Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen. The effort was headed by Wisdom, a religiously affiliated social justice organization, which has an ongoing campaign aimed at cutting Wisconsin's incarcerated population in half by 2015. Well, we're joined now by Reverend Jerry Hancock. He's a volunteer with Wisdom, as well as the director of the Prison Ministry Project and former deputy district attorney in Dane County. Jerry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
So you spent a lot of time working with inmates in Wisconsin's prisons. What did you see there when it came to inmates waiting for parole?
Well, what we found is that parole has virtually stopped in Wisconsin. There are about 3,000 inmates in Wisconsin prisons, almost all of them men, who were sentenced under what we call old law, which was the law as it existed prior to truth in sentencing coming into effect in 1999. So these people are legally eligible for parole. They were given sentences by judges that assumed they would have a fair chance at parole. And that process has virtually stopped. 10 years ago, about 25% of the inmates who were eligible for parole were granted parole. In 2012, which is the last year we have data for, only 5% were granted. So the process has come to a stop, and that's what we're concerned about.
So before truth in sentencing, a judge might hand down a longer sentence knowing that only, say, 25% would be served.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And we've had judges actually write to inmates saying, I can't believe you're still in prison. That was never my intent.
So what specifically is your group asking for when it comes to reform?
Well, the first thing we'd like to do is have a meeting with the governor, because this issue is one that is completely within the governor's control. It doesn't require any new legislation. These inmates are under the control of the executive branch of government. In truth in sentencing, a judge decides when a person will get out of prison. But these inmates, the governor has control. So we'd really like to meet with the governor and have family members be able to explain to him what the problems are, what the injustices are. So the first thing we'd like to do is have a meeting with the governor. Then we'd like the governor to direct the Secretary of Corrections and the Parole Commission to put this house in order, to come up with a rational process, to reinstitute the parole system as it existed 10 years ago, so people get a fair chance.
So you want to have a meeting with the governor. That's square one. Where are you with that?
Nowhere. That's why we met yesterday with Secretary Wall and the Attorney General and other statewide leaders in the criminal justice system to bring this issue to them. Hopefully they have the credibility, the responsibility, and the access to address this issue and get the governor's attention.
Now, one of the things that you say is happening is that there is very little compassionate release, this being when an inmate is elderly, possibly sick or dying, and that many of these people are dying in prison. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. The issue of compassionate release is a very serious one, and it's getting more serious day by day and year by year as Wisconsin's prison population ages. So we're going to need hospice care. We're going to need long-term dialysis. All those things are going to become required by Wisconsin prisons because constitutionally, if you put someone in prison, you're responsible for their health care. If some of these men and women could be released at end of life, they could be cared for in nursing homes. We have nursing homes that are ready, willing, and able to take them. They could be closer to their families. They could be covered by Medicare and Medicaid and not be a burden to Wisconsin taxpayers. So all of this makes really good sense, both morally and financially, to enhance the compassionate release program that now exists in Wisconsin.
Now, you have some other issues that are, there are four of them, actually. Can you run us through the rest of them that are part of this package reform that you're asking for?
Yeah, the campaign is called Reform Now, and there are actually four issues. Restoration of the parole process, compassionate release, solitary confinement, and unfair and unreliable revocations for people that are on parole. The solitary confinement issue is one that is a real concern to us as a faith-based organization because by international standards, if a person is kept in solitary confinement more than 15 days, that's considered torture. And by the Department of Corrections' own standard, at least 20%, one in five, of the inmates in Wisconsin are kept in solitary confinement more than 30 days, some for more than a year, for some more than a decade. And so we have to end the torture that's going on in Wisconsin prisons. We also need to look at the issue of revocation, people that have been released and are being sent back to prison for violating either rules that are antiquated, like having a cell phone or using a computer, or bad technology. They're on a bracelet, a GPS bracelet that fails through no fault of their own. They're thrown in jail for days or weeks. They lose their job. They lose their apartment, all because of bad technology. So those are the four issues we really want to see addressed.
Now, the issue of solitary confinement, that has been one that has been out there in our consciousness for the last year or so. People are really zooming in on that particular issue. Can you tell us about someone who that affected?
Sure. And the reason I think that it's been in our consciousness is because of a very brave and dramatic thing that that a person who has deep connections to Madison experienced, and that's Rick Ramish. Rick Ramish was for many years the sheriff of Dane County. He was the Secretary of Corrections under Governor Doyle, and now he's the Secretary of Corrections in Colorado. And Rick Ramish voluntarily spent a night in solitary confinement in Colorado. And he was so affected by that experience. He wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times and has testified before Congress saying, "Solitary confinement does more harm than good. These people are going to be released back into our community. We cannot treat them like this." So Rick Ramish has really focused the issue of solitary confinement. And since he has such strong Wisconsin connections, I think that's really motivated a lot of people to get involved.
Now, you talked us through your four points that you're hoping will be addressed. Are any of them seeming likely to be picked up on right now by the Criminal Justice Advisory Board?
That's a good question. Frankly, it's the governor that needs to get involved in this because the governor controls the prison system. The governor controls the parole system. The governor controls indirectly who spends time in solitary confinement and how much. So it's really the governor that needs to act. We went to the Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee because, first of all, the governor wouldn't talk to us. And secondly, they're the people, the second level people that have day-to-day responsibility for these programs. And our feeling was that if they were aware of the problems of old law parole, solitary confinement, compassionate release, unfair and unreliable revocations, that they could get the governor's attention. Secretary Wall has more authority than most, and he could do a lot to regularize the parole process, and he could do a lot on solitary confinement. And at the meeting yesterday, he did indicate that solitary confinement does go on in Wisconsin. He's very concerned about it. He's appointed a high-level committee within the Department of Corrections to address the issue and is willing to continue to meet with us. And that's a very good start.
Governor Scott Walker authored the Truth in Sentencing legislation. It's some of his signature legislation, in fact. Does that make your journey here an uphill battle?
I think an uphill battle is the very least of what it is. Scott Walker, Governor Walker, is very proud of being one of the authors of Truth in Sentencing. And what Truth in Sentencing was meant to do is take away the discretion of the Department of Corrections and give that discretion to judges. And that whatever time a judge gave someone to serve in prison, they were going to serve every day of that sentence. And it's a fact that if an inmate in Wisconsin won the Nobel Peace Prize, there's nothing that the Department of Corrections could do to change even one day of that sentence. That was not the law, though, before 1999. Scott Walker is not the author of the old law. Scott Walker is the author of the new law. And what's happening is Scott Walker is trying to apply new law standards to old law cases. And judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys ought to be outraged by that.
And we're going to leave it there. Jerry, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much, Frank.
We've been speaking with Reverend Jerry Hancock, director of the Prison Ministry Project and former deputy district attorney in Dane County. Yesterday, he, along with 100 activists, met at the State House to call for parole reforms in the state's prisons. Well, who doesn't love a good nautical mystery? That's what's on tap today in Curious Wisconsin. 335 years ago, a French ship known as Le Griffon, or the Griffin, set sail from Washington Island as part of its maiden voyage, only to disappear forever, at least until now. Maybe. Historians think the Griffin was the first European ship to sail the Upper Great Lakes and the first one to sink there, but little evidence has been found of the vessel. But our next guest says that after years of searching, he's finally found the ship's remains on the bottom of Lake Michigan. He's hoping for a full excavation of the vessel and says there's a lot more we can learn from it. Joining us now is Steve Liebert. He's the president of the Great Lakes Exploration Group. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, Steve, you've been a little obsessed with the Griffin since you were a kid. How did you first get so fascinated with it?
You know, and that's a great word, Veronica, obsession and passion. But believe it or not, I was 14 years old, and I'm 60 years old now. But when I was 14, I was in eighth grade, and one of my history teachers, they were talking, or he was talking about early European exploration into the present interior of the United States. And he was talking about La Salle. He talked about his ship Griffin and the figurehead, which was part lion and part eagle. And I was just mesmerized by the story and actually just basically sitting in class dreaming, you know, about that ship. And he'd walk right behind me and put his right hand on my left shoulder and said, who knows, maybe someone in this room will find it one day.
Wow.
And so it was a teacher that had a lot of influence. And a lot of impact on my life as far as looking for the Griffin.
Well, something about that story fascinated you to this day, and maybe some of it has to do with the history of the ship itself. Can you talk us through a little bit about what the Griffin was and what its journey was like before it sank?
Yes. La Salle obtained permission from King Louis XIV to build a ship above the Niagara Falls, in which he did, and he obviously named it the Griffin. And it set sail in 1679, And I take that back, 1678. It was actually under construction. But so it set sail. It took less than a year to build the vessel. And as far as we know it, and from the research primary source documents, the Griffith made it to present-day Washington Island. And then LaSalle decided that he needed to resupply, so he sent the Griffin back to present Kingston, Canada. And at the time, it was Fort Frontenac. So the Griffin left Washington Island. LaSalle took canoes and the rest of his men, and he went to the southern lake, part of Lake Michigan, to wait for the Griffin's return, but it never returned. Some years later, LaSalle came back and finally transitioned down through the Mississippi River to present-day New Orleans, which he obviously claimed the territory for King Louis XIV, and then a lot of the lands west of the Mississippi River, known as the Louisiana Territory. Now, a lot of that land we know today as the Louisiana Purchase when in 1803 President Jefferson sent James Monroe over to actually purchase New Orleans, but Bonaparte decided, hey, I have this other land, and you can have it for $15 million. And they were ready to spend $10 million for New Orleans. But so Monroe thought to himself, well, you know, if it's that other land, let's take it for $15 million. Why not? And now what's the importance of it? Well, it actually expanded the United States twofold at that time in 1803. And the United States built forts, and they expanded further to the West Coast, Pacific Ocean, which is a natural line of defense. So,
so a long history there.
That's a long history,
leading from the Griffin. Why do you think you found it?
Well, you know, we've been searching for this vessel for many years. A lot of people were looking in Lake Huron, and I can understand why. But you know, I sort of went a step further as far as the research, and discovered primary source documents in the French archives. And, of course, we had those documents translated two or three times by experts in French. Each translation always said something a little different. And that got me to believing that this ship didn't go down Lake Huron. It went down Lake Michigan. And in that primary source documents, in some of those pages, they actually describe the islands in the land. And I said, that can only be one place, and that's the Garden Islands that, you know, tip up Green Bay, and which actually is Wisconsin, and then it goes into Michigan. And we went looking, and then in 2001, I bumped into what I thought was a bowsprit. Now, in 2001, you have to remember, a lot of the zebra mussels just started, as far as the northern Lake Michigan started coming into those waters, and visibility was only about 3 to 6 inches where we were diving. Today, it's probably 25, 30 feet because of the zebra mussels have cleaned up the water that good. And now the zebra mussels are dying off because there's nothing else to eat.
Right. So found that one plankboard back several years ago. Now you've got a whole area that seems to be some detritus and wreckage there. What makes you think that this is the Griffin?
Well, I won't go through the whole process because we finally took years to get the French archaeologists over to actually dive on this piece of timber we thought was a bowsprit. And then we also had to go through the legal process to obtain permits and so we can excavate. Well, last June we excavated the bowsprit. It was extracted. The scientists, we studied it quite a bit, and we found out from erosion marks that piece is at least 200 to 300 years old. And, you know, if it's 300 years old, there's only one documented ship that we know of that ever went down in the Upper Great Lakes, mm-hmm. and that's the Griffin. So now what happened last year, our permits ran out. We only had 6 days on location. This year we went back out and started doing more remote sensing work using the sector scan sonar. And we found more wreckage. And then we sent divers down. Water was extremely cold. But Tommy Gwine of Great Lakes Diving and Salvage and Joe Schaefer did an excellent job. They're in hot water suits walking along the bottom, and they're looking at this wreckage and then taking photographs and pictures of the fittings that are part of the wreckage. The only problem, Veronica, we weren't finding any cultural materials like, you know, pottery, tools, eating utensils, that sort of thing. And then I went back to look at some surveys that I had performed probably almost 15 years ago, and I couldn't believe it. I said we were right on top of it the whole time, because it did show off magnetic anomalies. So what we believe that to be is the hull of the ship buried. And that's where we're going to find the cannons and the cannonballs and,
wow,
and cultural material.
So that's remarkable. So what would you like to see done with this ship if it is indeed the Griffin? And what would it mean to you if it is? And I'm sorry, we've only got about 30 seconds left.
Well, real fast, the ship belongs to France, so that's her call. But I would like to see it extracted, reassembled, and put into a museum somewhere. That would be France's call. And it could be Wisconsin, it could be Illinois, it could be Michigan. I know there's a couple groups that want to build a replica of the Griffin for the tall ships display. And but I would just like to see it displayed so people can actually see it and let people know of all the techniques that we used. The ship has been, our process has been legal, political, I mean, you name it, in technical. And but we overcame all those obstacles to prevail. And next year, September, we're going back out again, hopefully to excavate.
And we have to leave it there, Steve. Good luck to you. It's fascinating stuff. Steve Liebert is the president of the Great Lakes Exploration Group.